So you bought an existing pub that was running as a pub. How much did you pay for it?
£310.
And you got planning to do what to it?
To change it into a 14-bed HMO.
Do you know what value is now?
£1.2 million now. The value is what we're going to get valued at. There is another value that matters.
What's your monthly cash flow now?
£10,885.
So that was a £400,000 build. But we was quoted £1 million from builders.
And then we refinanced at £1.1 million. So we effectively got all our money out with a bit of cash left over. We paid £210 for a 3-bed terraced. We sold it for £385 in the same year.
Do you know what your portfolio is valued at right now today?
£3,050,000.
So Hudson Harley, welcome to Winners on a Wednesday. Over the last few years, you've absolutely exponentially seen a lot of growth in your property portfolio. How did you get into property in the first place? What made you get into property and how did this empire start?
We just decided to get into it to build something together so that Harley didn't actually have to work for anybody else. He worked for himself from day one. He's never been employed. And we're building our own portfolio to create generational wealth.
And you guys are brothers?
Brothers, yeah.
So what's your background then?
So my background was, I'd done mixed martial arts up until I was about 17. So I had like over 100 amateur fights and I was going to go down that path. And then I decided to go to university. So I went and studied business and management at university. And then when I was coming like about midway through that course, that's when we decided to go into property. So on finishing university, I went straight into the business and decided to grow that rather than go into the corporate world.
And at the time, you had a construction company, is that right?
Yeah, I've always had an engineering company for about 10 years.
Yeah.
So my background is in construction. And I was always to do property, but I needed some more time.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I had some money to get going. We'd done some training, we got ourselves moving, and then Harley had unlimited time because it was his job then to build our business, but he was doing it on his own terms.
I love the way you've kind of brought your skills together as well. You know, you had a bit of time, you just finished university, you had a bit of money from your engineering business.
Yeah.
Talk me through the first deal then. I believe that was in about, 5 years ago now?
Yeah, it was 2018.
Yeah.
So we went up to do a business meeting up in Blackburn. So we thought we'd look at some houses up there at the same time. We viewed 13 houses, ended up buying a little 2-bed buy to let for 42,000. So I paid cash for that. Then we lived up there for a month when that went through, just on fishing beds in the house, rips it all out, really just the hard way. Harley learned a lot on that job because it was his first build job. Learned how to fit kitchens, bathrooms. And then from then on, we just built it and expanded it. So that was a baby stepping stone.
And you bought it for 42 grand?
Yeah.
Did you have to pay stamp duty or was it uninhabitable?
No, we did pay stamp duty.
A tiny bit. I was going to say, if you're going for under 40, you don't pay stamp duty.
Yeah, so it was a tiny bit
of stamp. So talk me through the figures then on that deal, if you remember them 5 years later. So you bought it for 42. How much did you spend doing it up? I know you did some of the works yourself. But how much
so we only spent 10,000 doing it up. Nice. So that included all the expenses as well, driving from Kent to Blackburn.
Yeah.
So the actual spend was about 6,000 on it. So that was labour and materials. So like shopping around at B&Q, getting the kitchen for £800.
Yeah.
Because it was on sale.
Yeah.
And bringing it all together
It's amazing that you can refurb a house when you're on it and you're project managing it yourself, how cheap you can actually do a refurb for like a full refurb for 10 grand. That's madness.
Yeah. Labour's free, so.
Yeah, because you do it yourself.
Yeah, that's the kicker. When you get a builder in, that's when the costs come up and everyone starts paying mega money for what essentially is a small job.
Do you manage all your own projects yourself?
Yes. Yeah,
I guess that really helps with BRR because the whole point of buy refurbishy finance is you want to buy it as cheap as you can. You want to get the refurb done, obviously to a good standard, but as cheap as possible. And then you want to get that end valuation as high as possible.
Yeah.
And the refurb is where a lot of people, it just runs away, doesn't it?
The thing is, when you manage it yourself, you've got 20, 30, 40% buffer.
Yeah.
So you could have a really high end finish and you can pay the money out at the end because you've saved it the whole way through.
Yeah.
So you can get out of a lot of problems yourself.
Well, have you still got that property today? Do you still own it?
Yeah.
What's it worth now?
About 75,000.
Cool. And you refinanced it?
So we refinanced it straight away. So we got it valued at 68 straight after the works. And then after that, we've just left it now. So when we do refinance it, we don't take any more money out. We just get a new mortgage product.
Is that kind of what you've done? Has your strategy been, you obviously had a little bit of money to begin with from working hard on your engineering company. Is that what you've done? Have you just sort of recycled the money again and again and again?
Yeah, we've essentially grown from that part. I've continued to put in bits for the early stages, but we're at a stage now where the property company outstrips what we could put in.
Right.
So we're now into the realms of investors and banks and bigger projects. And every project now is around £1 million.
And you've done, how many projects have you done in the last few years since that first one?
So we've done 7 projects and we've kept 5 of them.
Yeah.
And sold off two, yeah.
And what's your monthly cash flow now from the property business?
So the property business cash flow is 24,000. We're just over 24,190. But that's totally passive.
And that's revenue turnover or that's actual profit?
No, that's revenue.
Revenue turnover.
Sure. And then what about how much are you left with after you've paid all your...
£10,885.
You know the exact number. I like it. Yep. I remember when you came to the Accelerated Coaching Performance Program, when you sort of finished with all the academy training and you had this big, thick... Do you remember?
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
No, we brought basically a guide of what we do and how we did it.
Yeah.
And telling our story from day one to where we're going to end up. And you had it all in black and white, so you knew where we was. So when we discussed things, you can see it.
I did. I remember seeing all these addresses.
Yeah.
When you showed me all these. And I thought that it was stuff in the pipeline. But you're like, no. We refinanced that one. We did that one. And I was shocked at how much, because when you're going through the academy, you guys, you're quite quiet, kind of keep your heads down. You know, you'd come to the training and stuff like that, but you weren't like up and speaking and super vocal.
Yeah.
You just cracked on and you were quietly just buying, refurbing, refinancing, and you've built, you know, really, really, really good sales portfolio now. So what would you say has been the key to your success of being able to scale to the extent that you have in the time that you have?
I'll say the self-management and motivation. At no point have we stopped.
Yeah.
We didn't get a deal and think, right, we'll do this and we'll get to the end of it and find another one. We've always had a pipeline that we're building, and then through the dead periods, we've gone out actively looking, and now we've got people just ringing us saying that we've got HMO available, it's 24 beds, do you want to buy it? Well, yes. You know, so we're now bringing the work to us as opposed to finding it.
What has been your most exciting project, the one that you're most proud of?
Probably the Wellington, because it was our first large HMO. So it was a 14 bed, former pub / hotel. Pretty bad standards, needed complete gutting. So the only thing we kept is just the four walls. So that was a £400,000 build, but we was quoted £1 million from builders and we brought in for 400. So that's probably the one that I'm most proud of.
So talk me through the figures on that one then.
We purchased it at 310. We spent 400 on it. We got obviously the cost of purchase and finance, and then we refinanced at 1.1 million. So we effectively got all our money out with a bit of cash left over to go into the next deal.
And that's a HMO?
Yeah. 14 bed.
And how much does that bring in per month?
So that brings in 9,800 a month.
Damn. So that's like almost half of your revenue is coming from one deal.
Yeah. So we've doubled up now on that. So the numbers have gone up by another 9,000 now, 9,500, because we've got a 16 bed we've just finished. We're just going for a refinance on that in the next couple of months.
Where's your patch? Have you got one area or are you just buying all over?
So predominantly we're based in Sheffield.
Yeah.
So the large majority of the portfolio is in Sheffield.
But you're based in Kent.
Yeah.
How did you come about finding your patch in Sheffield? How did that happen?
We based on a year's research on various towns and cities, and it's the most populated, fastest growing city that's on the quiet. So it's not Manchester, Birmingham or London. It's the fourth biggest city in the UK, and not many people realise that population-wise. They've all got to live somewhere. There's plenty of students there. There's loads of professionals there, and there's a lot of growth. When we first went there wasn't two cranes in the city. Now there's 20 cranes every day. You know, if you look across the city, now there's towers going up everywhere. So it's the place to be. And we've seen house prices. We've done a couple of flips. We paid £210 for a three-bed terraced. We sold it for £385 in the same year.
Damn.
So the finish is what gets you the money ultimately. But the right areas, there's still areas in Sheffield that you wouldn't want to buy the houses in. But in the right postcodes and the right roads, if you know where they are, you can smash it.
Do you know what your portfolio is valued at right now today?
Yeah, 3,050,000.
Wow. And when you started off?
Yeah.
Started off with 42 grand place.
And now it's a £3 million property portfolio.
Yeah. And effectively, if you lived a normal life, you wouldn't have to work, so.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, making over £10,000 profit a month from a portfolio which is snowballing up in value. I mean, it's life-changing stuff.
Yeah. Like I say, every deal that we do now, we want to try and get £1 million per deal, so.
£1 million profit?
No, £1 million per deal. So each deal, each HMO end value would be around £1 million or more. So we're no longer doing 4, 5, 6 beds because they're just not stacking up in the market. So
and also it makes sense because, I always say, don't grow this way, grow this way. Because if you end up with 100 houses all over the place, you've got 100 boilers, 100 families. But if you can start doing bigger deals, it takes just as much effort to do a big deal and a small deal, really.
Well, this is, it's the same paperwork.
Yeah.
It's just bigger numbers.
And especially with the maintenance. Like we've had a few issues, a little bit of painting required. when you send them out to a 14-bed HMO, when you're paying the builder for a day, you split that between 14 rooms. Mm. Whereas if that's a little 4-bed, he's still got to go out for a day and you've only got 4 rooms to split it against.
Yeah.
So effectively that month it wasn't worth running. Whereas on the 14-bed, we could have a builder out a few days a month and it still is worth having it there.
How do you manage the projects then? If you're based in Kent and you've got properties mostly in Sheffield, how do you project manage it from that distance?
So I stay on site.
Right.
So, and up until the latest project, I spent the first 2 weeks there and then I managed it going up and down. So it's just simple. I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, travel up there and travel back the same day or stay over that night.
The market's changed a lot the last couple of years. What was the year when we met and you did it came to the Property Investors Crash Course?
It was a year ago.
About a year ago.
Yeah, 2022.
Wow. Okay, so even in the last year though, like the market's changed a lot. A year ago, if you'd go to estate agents and you'd say, oh, I'm looking for a cheap rundown property that I can buy and push the value up, they'd be like, join the queue. And things were selling like hotcakes.
Yep.
Whereas now it's more of a buyer's market and you can get properties a lot cheaper, but at the same time, interest rates are higher. You know, properties might not be worth as much at the end value. So you need to be conservative with the refinance. So what have you found? How have you found the market to have changed and how has that affected your strategy and your approach?
I think everything's relative in terms of it doesn't matter when you buy or when you sell. It is what it is. You can't change it. But what we have found is that when we go in to get a deal, they always want top dollar. They always want to put the prices up. Because we show the interest to purchase it as developers, as landlords, they're like, it must be worth it then.
Mm.
You know, they're looking at us rather than us having to sort of haggle over a price. It's more okay to say, look, it's worth this. It's a take it or leave it deal.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't go and look at the price anymore. We look at what the building is, what it's worth to us, make an offer.
Right. You know? So you just work your numbers backwards.
Yep.
Yeah.
End value is going to be X minus the refurb cost, minus our profits.
Yep.
This is what we can buy it for. Who cares what the asking price is? Who cares what the value is today? This is the price I can pay.
The value is what we're going to get valued at.
Yeah.
You know, there is no other value that matters. If you could say it's worth $1 million, if I can only value it at 900, it's never worth $1 million to me.
Yeah.
You know, but we had one the other week that was 49-bed HMO across 2 buildings. They wanted £3 million. Cash flow works out fine, but the place was a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
So when you factor in a refurb, emptying them for probably a year, it doesn't work. You know, the costs have to reflect what needs doing.
Yeah.
You know, the cash flow works, and this is why the big HMOs need to maintain them meticulously, because after 4, 5, 6 years, the cash flow's still there and you'll still keep it, but it's not advertisable. People don't want to live there.
Mm.
You know, and when you purchase them, there's no profit because you're buying at market value.
Right.
So we have to buy, you know, as if it's not been refurbed.
What do you think people's biggest mistakes is when going about this strategy, when trying to buy houses, do them up? What do you think the common mistakes that you see people doing all the time are?
It's definitely spending too much money to begin with. And then it's employing the wrong builder.
Mm.
So like a lot of people, they buy a house, they think they can give it to a builder and turn back up when the job's done.
Yeah.
That's not how it goes. Like, you can go on the weekend to check on your builder. You can go up there and have a look at the job. But if you don't see it through the stages and just wait till the end, as soon as it is finished, it might look nice, but behind the scenes is what's going to cost you money. So if all the plumbing isn't done correctly, electrics, especially with HMOs, because a lot of builders don't know the regs.
Right.
So where we organise it and bring all the guys in, I give them a list of all the jobs that need to be done, but that's in correlation with the regulations.
Yeah.
Whereas like when you just put a normal builder in and say, right, I want a HMO, you're expecting them to go and have to do all the research.
Exactly.
On all the requirements, right. The fire doors. They just haven't got the time. And if a builder does know them requirements, he's going to charge you for it.
Mm.
So then the deal might not stack.
Right. That's so true. And a lot of people will just say to a builder, how much to refurb this property?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what are you talking about? What does that even mean? You need to be really specific about what you want, how you want it done, the spec. And if, as you say, if it is a HMO, you need to know, does it need emergency lighting? Does it need fire doors? Does it? The builder doesn't know.
No.
I think, you need to know.
Yeah, one of the biggest things we have found is that if you do provide all the detail, the quote will come back horrendously high.
Mm.
So delivering it yourself and bringing in trades, like trades within organically. So you bring a plumber and you bring electricians in and you build your own team on the site is the best way of doing it financially.
Yeah.
You know, whether you've got time or not, you know, if you've given up your time, you'll save the money.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to give up your time, you have to pay the money.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, that's as simple as really.
Yeah. Or partner with somebody that, and I know this is one of the things that I've been getting you to do, which is to get investors on board that I've got a bit of money.
Yeah.
And collaborate with people that know what they're doing and know how to do it.
Well, this is it. I mean, the biggest thing is getting into the next level of investors. So yeah. Away from people's personal money and getting into pots of money and funds. They've got a goal. They need to hit targets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a straight up business.
Yeah.
It's not a transaction between two people anymore. It's company to company.
Yeah.
So that's the road we want to get to.
What did you think when you came to the crash course and you saw, because obviously you've got a background in construction,
yeah.
You're doing your property business. What sort of changed in your sort of strategy and approach in the last year or so?
We never actually come to the crash course originally. We just signed up. We just come straight to your house and had the chat.
You were just like, I know I'm in.
It was just a case of it's the next stage in our progression.
Yeah.
So we joined for 1%. If we got 1% of value out of it, it was worth doing.
Right.
You know, because it's not about learning everything. We're already in the trade. We're already doing it. We're already free finance, getting all our cash out every time. It's a case of what is the 1% we can pick up from you that you do that we don't.
Right.
And that's the difference.
And what was the 1%, or hopefully more than 1%?
Well, the big part for me was the marketing. So on the accelerated, you know, training,
yeah.
It was the marketing. It was bang, simple, straight to the point. And that's what we come for, was the answers.
Understanding,
not the fluff.
Understanding how to, raise finance, get yourself out there, be seen.
More with the branding side.
Okay.
So actually creating the brand.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time it's always just been us, we're doing this and people know about it.
Mm.
But we never, like you say, we've been quite reserved and we haven't stood up and said, right, we know HMOs inside out.
Yeah.
Probably more than most people, because we're just going about our business and growing naturally and organically. Definitely increasing the branding. And then since the course, we actually have taken on a rent to rent. So
nice.
We took on an SA. It's only been live for a month, so the figures, but it should be expected to make around 1,000 at least every month. But that actually takes a little bit of time to manage, whereas the portfolio is with a letting agent. So there isn't any management time with that now.
Yeah. What's been the biggest challenge over the last few years?
I would say it's the opposite to what you have. So if we've got the money, we haven't got the deal. And if we've got the deal, then we've got to go and find the money. And that was it. When you're looking for something, it's never there. And then when you're just getting about your business, you find the deals, the money will come, but you don't know where it's going to come from necessarily.
Yeah.
What we found is obviously like people come to us and say, look, I've got some money. We're like, fine, keep them on the back burner. We know where they are. And then when the deals come through, we can then stack them up and get the deals done. Having our own money has always been the kicker.
Yeah.
You know, because we've got our money and then we replaced our money with investors' money. So our money's still in the pot, it's still circulating. So that every time we go to an investor, if they do ultimately fall away, we've still got our own money to complete the deals.
Yeah.
So we've never failed to complete.
It's so much easier to raise money when you've got a bit of money yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started out in property, it's like 17, 18, 19, buying houses. It was really hard. And every time I'd ask the bank for a loan, they'd be like, no, we're not giving you a loan. But then as soon as I became wealthy, like now I've got money, I can't go into the bank without them saying, would you like a loan?
Yeah.
I'm like, where were you 12, 13 years ago? And I think that we do the same. We keep a bit of money. And then every time we need to raise money, it's easy because we can say, look, we could raise it ourselves if we wanted to, but we want to give you an opportunity to have a share of the deal. And there's only so many deals we can finance ourselves. And you're coming from a position of abundance rather than desperation. But what would you say if you were starting again from scratch and you had no money? See, I'm pretty confident that with your knowledge and the network that you've got, and you've got a nice big network now, you're on the academy as well, which has been great. And it's a massive part of, I believe, net worth is also network, who you know. But if you're starting again from scratch, and you had no money, but you had your experience and you had your network, what would the first steps you would be to go and start again to build your portfolio?
If I had zero money, I'd do rent to rent to SA.
Yeah.
I would. And I'd have it all systemized and managed out. And that's the one thing I've sort of probably got from the academy that I wouldn't have had before because I wasn't looking at it.
Mm.
So it's not necessarily something that I'm going to go down that road of doing all the time, but we have started just so that I've got the experience. We've got the setup.
Mm-hmm.
If the deal comes along, it can drop in the portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm starting again, I'd go down that road for cash flow.
Yeah. Why would you choose that strategy?
It's fast cash. Cash in the bank. And once you're getting 20, 30 grand a month, you don't need 200, 300, 400 grand in the bank because you can attract that. But without zero coming in, you can't be out there attracting the money.
Mm.
So I'd say that plus the marketing would be where I'd start.
I think that makes sense. What about yourself?
I think I'd definitely start with deal selling.
Okay, interesting.
Just because I feel then you aren't opening yourself up to any risk either.
Right.
So I'd try and make myself as valuable middleman as I could.
Mm.
So I would go into the networks where the investors are, find the deals, even if I had to give away like a few away for free at first, if you can create value,
yeah,
then you can charge.
Yeah.
Whereas if I took on a rent to rent and you didn't have no money, then if it didn't do too well, then you are financially liable. Whereas if you're just selling the deal, and once you've sold two or three, then you've got enough money to then be able to do an essay.
Yeah.
So I definitely start with deal selling and then move into rent to rent and save the funds and then do BRR.
Yeah. I think buy, refurbish, refinance, like what you're doing, that will build a lot of wealth. You've got now a £3 million portfolio. It's bringing in revenue of over 20 grand a month. But it is quite slow because...
Yeah, it's very slow.
Just to complete on a deal is going to take you 6 months.
Every deal is 12 months. For the minute you start buying it to when you get a refinance, it's a minimum of 12 months.
Right.
Yeah, unless it's a tiny deal. And we've just done 16 bed HMO in 9 weeks. So from keys to completion is 9 weeks for the build. We've now got tenants in. It will be at least another 3 months before we get a refinance.
Mm.
So 9 weeks plus 3 months as a minimum.
Yeah.
You know, and that's...
Plus we had a 2-year purchase on that as well.
Oh, so damn.
It first come about 2 years ago, and then probably 6 months ago is when we actually got the price agreed. So it took 18 months to agree the price.
It happens, man.
It started super high.
Yeah.
And it was just a case of our number was where we thought it was worth. And we only ended up 50 grand above where we started. And they had to come down several hundred of thousands.
Yeah.
But it was just them accepting it. So they left it on the market and no one brought it. Mm. And in the end, we was the only people left, so they phoned us up and said, all right, you can have it for this figure.
That's the thing about being a patient investor. You've got to be patient, I think, when it comes to investing in property.
There isn't hundreds of large deals. So that's like a 16 bed. It was already in HMO, but it was very tired.
Mm-hmm.
So it required probably for most people 150 to 200 grand spending on it. For us, we brought it in for 95. So it wasn't bad.
Brilliant. Someone said to me yesterday, I've got this deal and it's taking forever. What would you recommend I do? And I said, I'd recommend you leave it in your pipeline and go and get another deal. You've got to fill your pipeline. Because if you're just waiting for one deal to complete, oh, it's taking forever and all you're focused on that. You might be waiting a year. If you're buying properties, what you need to do is you need to fill your pipeline so you think, if everything all came off at once, I'd actually be screwed. So if something falls through, you go, thank God that fell through. When you've got a full pipeline of loads of deals, then you can afford to be patient. And when I say being patient, I'm not talking about not taking action. I think be patient, but then when the opportunity comes, then pounce and be ready.
Yeah, I think with the bigger deals, they tend to fall away more than the small deals anyway.
Yeah.
So you do need a couple of big deals always in the offing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we've had 2 or 3 fall away in the last 2 years, which were great deals. They fall away for various reasons, but generally it's because the paperwork isn't right behind the scenes.
Yeah.
You know, bad leases, planning wasn't there and it should have been, stuff like that. Stuff that's going to take a year to get resolved and the other side's not willing to meet you halfway on resolving it.
Mm.
So that's the nature of the big stuff because they're selling for a reason.
Yeah. Are you getting commercial valuations on some of the properties? Are you getting bricks and mortar valuations?
No.
Everything's commercial.
Yeah.
So how do you, with a HMO, what qualifies a HMO property to be a commercial HMO versus a bricks and mortar HMO?
So essentially it's a standalone HMO. It's not a house.
Okay.
Anything that's a house or can be used as a house will not get a commercial value.
Right.
7 ensuite bedrooms is perfect.
Yeah.
6 with ensuites, I've heard, getting done. But
it happens. It's not as common.
If it's got your sui generis planning, then all the way you're getting commercial.
So 7 bedrooms with ensuite rooms and you're pretty much okay generally to get a commercial valuation.
And in Article 4, if you can. So the latest one we just did is within Article 4. So most people are like, you can't do a HMO, you can't get them. No, you can, as long as the houses aren't around, don't exceed 20%.
Mm.
So we look for the pockets and we get the map and we make sure the surrounding houses, there aren't more than 20% as HMOs.
Interesting.
So a lot of people just avoid Article 4. So then the competition decreases.
Right.
But if it's less than 7, a lot of the times they use a hybrid valuation. So in between commercial and bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
So you aren't completely down on bricks and mortar, but it isn't as good as commercial.
So Article 4, you're right, a lot of people avoid Article 4. Just what is it? What does Article 4 mean?
It's just a set point from the council on the map where you cannot get more HMOs than what they'll allow.
So if it's Article 4, it means you can't just buy a house, rent it out room by room and turn it into a HMO unless you get planning permission.
Yes. Correct.
And we know that generally speaking, if an area is Article 4, they've probably made it Article 4 for a reason because they don't want more HMOs. So if it's not always... But if it's Article 4, generally people will go, it's Article 4, forget it. But what you do is the opposite. You go, oh, it's Article 4, like Sheffield is Article 4,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you'll go, I think it only became Article 4. I think it was a few years ago, wasn't it? You might know.
Yeah, it was before our time. It's been there at least 5 years.
Okay. I remember going to Sheffield. That's when I did my first Financial Freedom Challenge, see. And when I went, I think it had just come in. Yeah. Which, to be fair, yeah, that was November 2018. So I think it had just come in. But if an area is Article 4, no one's going there to do HMOs. But what you're saying is, if there's not too many HMOs and there's a ratio, then you know that you'll likely get planning. How do you find that information? Where do you get that from?
Well, initially, we were sort of on the HMO register on the council. We used to pin it on the wall on the big map that we printed out in the office.
Yeah.
But now with AI, you can just download a heat map and you can see where all the HMOs are saturated in the cities, and then put that onto an actual map, and then you can see whether it's blue, you've got a good chance, and you can work it out from there. So you can actually concentrate on the areas that haven't got many HMOs inside the area, rather than the red zones, which are saturated.
Right. So interesting.
We've made it work once on one of the deals.
How long did it take to get planning permission?
Standard 6 months.
Right.
It wasn't a hard deal because we had the evidence.
Yeah, yeah.
The hardest planning was probably the pub, because we had the pub association got against us saying you can't take a pub away when all the locals rejected against it, but they didn't even know what we was going to produce. So they were saying that they didn't want slums and all like that. And now there's a neighbour two doors down that's actually come in and seen it, and has got nothing but positive to say now around the community.
How long had the pub been empty when you took it on?
It wasn't empty.
No,
it was an actual pub.
It was an
actual,
we were staying there.
Oh.
So we were staying there.
No wonder you found that tricky. Damn. Because I know if it's been empty for a long time, then it's usually...
No, it was a going concern.
Wow. So you bought an existing pub that was running as a pub?
Pub, hotel and apartment.
But it was losing money. So it was unviable for the owners to keep running.
Yeah.
So if we didn't buy the property off him, then he would have gone bankrupt.
How much did you pay for it?
310.
And where was that? In Sheffield?
Yeah.
So you bought the pub for 310. How long did it take to get planning?
Took about 9 months, that one.
And you got planning to do what to it?
To change it into a 14-bed HMO.
Oh, nice. And you had uproar from the neighbours.
Yeah, we made the paper as well. That's not the first time
we
made
the
paper.
For all the wrong reasons, probably.
Yeah, they just slap you in the paper and shame you.
Greedy developers trying to turn this into a slum HMO.
Yeah.
And you still managed to get planning.
Yeah, we got a planning consultant on board that used to work in planning.
Yeah.
Coupled with our architect that was really good, and they got it through, they answered all the rejections.
Did you have to appeal, or did you get it through straight away?
Basically, we just had to give the council an extended period of time, because they come back and said, no, we aren't ready to make a decision yet. We need more time.
Yeah, they always do.
The architect turned around and told us, well, you can either force them in a decision, which they could say no, or you give them more time. And they just come up with a few more questions. Mm. So they said, rather than say no and send it to the appeal stage, answer these questions. So we answered them questions, had to do a viability report on why the pub couldn't run no more. After we submitted all of that, then they said yes.
I think getting planning permission is like, it's a game, isn't it, really? It's about understanding the politics, understanding the game of it, having a really good planning consultant. And again, you know, when you talked earlier about how people just think builders know everything, I've noticed that sometimes people think that builders know about planning permission as well. They'll be like, oh, can you get... the builder will be like, oh, you should be able to get planning. And the builders haven't got a clue about planning permission. Even the architects often don't know much about. You need to get an actual, when you're dealing with stuff like this, an actual planning consultant that knows, got connections to the council, knows the score, understands the game.
That's the key, is have local knowledge as well.
Yeah.
You know, having a planning consultant that's not in the city, it's not going to work for you.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, at the moment, the hotel's been done for a couple of years now. After the 5-year mortgage period, we're going to rebridge it and we're going to build another one at the back.
Beautiful.
So, yeah.
So how much do you have to spend on it then, turning it into a 14-bed HMO after you got planning?
So 400,000.
Damn.
It was slightly under, but it was...
So you bought it for 310, you spent just under 400, so you took about 700 in total. Do you know what the value is now?
It's 1.2 million now, because there's no rents. We've got it valued at 1.1 at the time, but the rents have gone up.
So you made $500,000 on that. Do you know how much you've made in equity over the 5 years? Do you know what you've...
It's about 850,000 now.
Just shy of £1 million equity.
Yeah.
Incredible. How does it feel? Do you ever pinch yourself when you're looking at the list that you showed me of all the properties that you've got and the values? Do you ever pinch yourself and think, damn, wow, that's quite impressive?
Going forward now, it's going to be a case of we've done really well in the period we've been going. I think as we look to go and do other stuff going forward, that it's going to be like looking back going, wow, that was amazing.
Mm.
It was an amazing 5 years.
What's the strongest reason? Where does the fire come from? You guys work extremely hard. You know, I know you go and live in Sheffield while there's refurbs going on. You're proper grafters, as well as, yes, you've got the education, the knowledge, you've got sharp minds, but you also work extremely hard. Where does that work ethic and that fire in the belly come from?
I think from when I grew up. So I'm never going to be poor again. So I went for a period when I left school to where I went and got my job. I was poorer having a job than I was going to school. So I'm never going to go back to that. I think that's my drive and my incentive. And now I've got a family and kids, you know, I'll support them throughout.
Yeah. I think often it's the case, isn't it? When you grow up with not very much, a lot of very successful people did start with nothing, even on the Sunday Times Rich List. People like to think, oh, you got lucky, or oh, your parents inherited, you know, left you a load of money. But actually, it's the super successful people often started with very little.
Yeah, I don't think others can have the same drive. So it's the same as being an athlete when you're rich. It's very hard to have the drive. So I look at it the same way. Like, if you grew up with everything, why do you want to go out there and work hard? Because you don't have to. Whereas when you don't have it, you've got one choice. You either carry on not having it or you work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like second nature. So for me personally, my mum's always worked hard. So why wouldn't I work hard now?
How important do you think mindset is to this game? Because there's a lot of technical skills that you need to understand and know. We've talked about planning permission and valuations and negotiations. But how important do you think having the right mindset is in this business?
I think definitely it's a people business. If you haven't got the right mindset and you don't stick to it and you don't see things through and you stop halfway, no one's ever going to invest with you.
Mm.
Even if the deal's going wrong or going right, if you see it through to the end, ensure that everyone's abreast of all the details, yeah, you're always going to succeed in the end. Yeah. Not every deal is going to make you a millionaire, but you know, along the way, you're going to learn lessons that are going to help you later on.
What's been your worst property deal?
I think it's one of the flips, definitely. Both flips we've done to earn more cash to then buy more HMOs, and both of them turned into disasters for different reasons. But it didn't kill the deal. They just created another learning.
Tell me about it.
Car Road was the first one in Sheffield. We took on a three-bed, so we stayed at the hotel. So the hotel come subsequently by doing that flip. So everything works well. But we was up there, we ripped it all out, gave it to the builder and said, right, see you in a couple of weeks. Went back after a few weeks. Everything was ripped out, looked good. Started putting it back together. You get the usual, this doesn't feel quite right. So we went up every week, started having the proper look. And then basically things were getting done quite quickly because he was cutting corners. So you see all the floorboards are down, carpets down, and every sort of thing you've gone from building site to almost finished in about 2 weeks. So the alarm bells were on the last visit we made before we parted company. So we went up there, walked through the flying freehold, and we knew we'd put an ensuite above and there's no drainage pipes below me. So I was like, I've got a definite problem here. We went in, went straight to the ensuite, running water, went to the back of the toilet, pulled the fitting off. There's no pipes in the floor. So he's got everything running, but he's got no drainage now. So the minute we'd sold it, it had flooded, we'd have had major problems.
Off.
You know, hopefully we'd have found that before we sold it, but we'd have had major problems, which we did anyway. So we ended up spending about 10,000, ripping back his work and doing good and making it right.
Damn.
But the profit was still in the job, so.
Still made profit.
Yeah, still made 25 grand on that deal.
Yeah.
I think it's because we only take deals on where we make sure the numbers, we're safe.
Yes.
That we can actually afford for it to go wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas if the deal was mega tight, like really, we just wouldn't get involved.
Mm.
Because A, there wouldn't be enough profit. And B, if it did go wrong, then you haven't got a backup plan. So there's always a contingency.
Yeah. What else do you look for in a deal? Do you literally just buy based on the numbers? Or is there anything else that you look for in a deal?
The property doesn't matter as long as it's got four walls and a concrete base.
Yeah.
That's it. Because everything we do, we rip it out back to brick generally. And you can see the sky from the front door. On all the big stuff, we try to replace everything we can. You know, so we don't get no comebacks. We don't get no issues. Maintenance is less.
So it's pretty much just a numbers game.
Definitely, because the location is important.
Yeah, because that results in the numbers.
That does result in the numbers. However, if the property's slightly out of town, so it's going to be less desirable, or we'll lower the rent slightly, and then we'll become desirable again,
yeah,
it just changes the numbers.
Yeah.
So every property will always rent no matter where it is.
Yeah.
It just depends on what number.
How are you making profits still with interest rates being so high? Because a lot of buy-to-let landlords are struggling because they're saying the rent's 800, the mortgage payments was 400, but now it's 800, I'm making nothing. But you're still making pretty damn good cash flow.
It's size and scale. If we had a load of four-bed HMOs, we wouldn't be making much money at all. But because we've got a 14-bed, 16-bed, it underpins everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's making enough money on its own.
Mm.
We don't need the other stuff.
Yes.
So the stuff that isn't making as much as it should, it's still making profit, even our smallest four beds making profit. But obviously it's not as much as it was 2 years ago.
But what about if you've just got a two up, two down buy to let with a family in there, then you're going to be very hard pressed.
All depends, because we've got the one in Blackburn, the one we first started with.
Mm.
Our mortgage is still only 137 on that.
Is that because you fixed it though, or is that?
No, because that's been refixed since. So
oh, really?
It come up for renewal. So it went up because we was only paying 87 quid a month on
that. Right. Yeah, it's true.
So it did go up, but we get 550 for that.
Yeah.
But yes, if you've got, definitely think if the house is worth a lot of money and then the rent isn't relative.
Mm.
So down south, you're definitely in trouble.
So it's about buying right, isn't it? If you're just an amateur landlord or an accidental landlord that just lives in a house and then you move on and you think, oh, I'll rent it, and then interest rates go up, it probably doesn't stack up. But if you buy right, so presumably when you buy, you're looking at two factors. You're looking at number one, can I push the value up by 25% so I can refinance and pull my money out? But number two, what's the cash flow going to be? And is it going to pass the stress test? Is it going to make me good cash flow? And those are the two sets of formulas I imagine you're looking at.
Yeah, they're the big things. If you've got a big buy to let, you've got to leave a big chunk of money in it.
Mm-hmm.
And our game isn't leaving money hanging around.
Yeah.
Even our own money, we get it out and get it working. If we've got money sitting in the bank, we'll lend it out to other people, the other investors, and make it work in the meantime.
Mm.
So we never have big pots of money sitting in the accounts. If we've got a couple of hundred grand sitting there free, we'll lend it out to someone, you know, get our returns on it. And then when our deal's ready to go, we'll call it back in time.
Talk to me about debt, because a lot of people go to school and learn, never be in debt. Debt's really bad. You are, you know, doing pretty well, just shy of £1 million in equity. You've also got £2 million worth of debt. How do you feel about that, being in £2 million worth of debt?
I've got another £1 million worth of debt with my own personal houses, so it doesn't bother
me. £3 million worth of debt?
Yeah.
Doesn't bother you?
No.
How come?
It's what makes me my money. You know, I'm leveraging from it. Without that, we would have a couple of buy-to-lets.
Yeah.
So we need to use debt.
Right.
You know, debt is the creator of the wealth.
It's good debt as well. So I think people just need to learn the difference.
Mm.
So if that was all on finance cars, yes, it wouldn't be a wise choice. However, the revenue it earns covers the debt. You've seen it covers it by 50%. So why would we ever be worried about having 2 million in debt?
Do you plan to pay the debt off at some point?
No.
No.
What will happen then? Ultimately, you'll just die old men with lots of debt.
No, my children will take my half and carry it on, or they'll sell it off with Harley's children ultimately. It'll be a group decision at the time.
Yeah.
But right now, we plan to keep the company long term, and it'll carry on past us.
Talk to me about your boxing plans as well now, because I know you injured your wrist, didn't you, or your hand pretty bad?
Yeah, so I had a life-changing accident on a glass vase, so sliced all the arteries, all the tendons, and I got told to never use my hand again. So thankfully, that's all healed now. But yeah, definitely, probably in the near future. I did try about 6 months ago to get back into it again, and I started going to the sparring, and I love every minute of it. But ultimately, I just didn't have the time with traveling to Sheffield. So we had to make all the classes. So I was doing two privates a week, and then I was doing the sparring on Fridays. But when you're traveling up to Sheffield and staying there, and you can't make it, as soon as you miss, like, for me, it's definitely, if I'm not consistent, then I don't want to do it. So I'm either all in or all out. But definitely with how the portfolio has gone now, I'll probably give it another shot at it, because I've actually got the time, because there isn't a lot of money in the kickboxing scene at all. So unless you make it to like one of the best in the world, now there's only just started becoming what you could actually live on. Before that, you'd always have to have a job or do a lot of PT and just to get by.
Yeah.
Whereas because I don't need that, and I don't need to fight for the money anymore, then I've got the ability to be able to pay for the training. And even if I don't get paid, just fight because I love it.
Yeah. I think it was you that said that it's hard to become a world champion fighter when you've got a lot of money. You're proving that maybe to be true. You know, now you've got a lot of money. It's like, what do I need to fight for? What do I need to step in the ring for? I know you've got plans as well to set up a boxing charity to help give back. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I've recently got my England coaching badges now for the local gym. So we help the kids Mondays and Saturdays. So my idea in the long run is about to do developments to have good causes. One of those is to open up boxing gyms that are self-funding from the properties above that are rented out, so that the gyms don't need the money, so that you can keep organically opening more gyms across the country to be able for all kids to be able to come and box for free. They might have to pay to come to the lessons, but that'll be put back into the charitable good, you know, shows and everything else that the That's kids great. Will be doing.
Yeah, and no, I respect it, man. I think it's really important. What would your final words of advice be to someone watching this? Maybe wants to get started in property, wants to follow in the footsteps of what you've done, wants to, you know, start taking advantage of the buyer's market that we're in right now. What advice would you give?
Probably have two. Be willing to do what others aren't.
Yeah.
And also don't listen to others. So when we first started and we'd done the first buy to let and it was earning 550, people were like, don't waste time, don't bother. And it's only now the portfolio's at over 3 million that you get the answers, oh, aren't you so lucky? It's all right for you. You don't have to now go to work.
Yeah.
But they wasn't there doing the years of hard work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that.
I'll say that training's key. Training and coaching. Get a mentor.
Yeah.
And get dragged forwards. You might have the want to do it, the motivation, but if you go in the wrong direction, you're not going up, you're going sideways.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I tell you what as well, like you guys, when you met me, you were already doing pretty okay. You were learning as you were kind of going. But I think it makes so much sense to learn from other people's mistakes rather than trying to figure out everything on your own. And it's been a real pleasure to work with you guys. I'm super impressed with what you've done. And I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing some super golden nuggets with people. I look forward to seeing your continued progression.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Cheers.